So, welcome everybody and thank you for coming. We are here to launch a book by Richard Youngs, who's on my left, called The Puzzle of Non-Western Democracy. Richard worked for an NGO called Fride in Spain for a long time, and now he works for Carnegie and is also a professor at the University of Warwick. And he's going to start, but I will introduce everybody and then... we've decided that people who come late should sit in the front.
Because we should get Chris to talk.
So the second, I think we'll go in the order you're sitting, if that's okay. So then we have Mukulika Banerjee, who is from India, and who directs the Asia Centre here at LSE and has written a lot about democracy in India. And then finally, and the awful thing is I forgot to ask you how I pronounce your name. We have Zeynep Aydin Düzgit.
Perfect.
From Bilgi University, but she's also a graduate of LSE and she works on European issues and Europe and Turkey and all sorts of issues. And she'll be our third speaker. But we will just, everybody's going to talk for 10 minutes each so we can really have a discussion with people from the floor. So let's start with Richard.
Okay, so I'll be very quick to go through the book in 10 minutes. Thank you to Mary for hosting. I've written a book, it's called The Puzzle of Non-Western Democracy. I've written it for a reason. The reason is, I think debates about different models of democracy, different models of political system, are becoming more prominent. You will all know this is not a new issue. It's an issue that's been debated for many decades. But in Carnegie, where I work, we felt this was an issue. So we began to realize this was an issue that was coming back to the top of the policy agenda. Lots of leaders from non-Western governments, developing countries, rising powers, are issuing much louder calls for non-Western models of democracy. Western governments themselves and international organizations seem to agree with the sentiment behind these calls for different models of democracy. This is a very complex debate about different models of democracy. It often takes place at quite a high level of theoretical abstraction. What I try to do in a book, if people are interested in reading it, is to try and make this subject fairly accessible and to make quite a crucial argument, and that is this is not simply an abstract theoretical debate. It has real-life practical implications, and in particular for the range of organizations, international organizations, that ostensibly at least are committed to supporting democratic reform around the world. We often hear quite powerful arguments today that if democracy is to survive and prosper in the future, it needs to have a kind of less Western tone to it. And organizations that support civil society, democratic reform around the world need to be doing a lot more than they're doing at the moment to support different varieties, different models of democracy. So everyone seems to agree with this agenda, and the fact that this agenda is becoming quite a prominent international issue. For me, the complicated question is what it really means in practice. And when you kind of dig beneath the surface and try to ascertain what non-Western models actually mean, there are many problems with this concept. So I phrased the book in terms of debates around non-Western democracy, not because I agree conceptually with the term non-Western democracy. I don't. And in fact, explicitly, one of the arguments the book makes is that it's very, very hard in practice to define with any degree of precision what a non-Western model of democracy is and exactly how it differs from reform efforts in Western countries. Basically, you have, and the risk of simplifying a little bit, you have two almost diametrically opposed positions in this very lively debate that's going on at the minute about different models of democracy. One position says Western-style liberal democracy has failed. It's hopelessly minimalistic. It's not delivering to its own citizens, let alone providing an aspirational reference point to other societies around the world, and that international organizations need to be promoting a radically different form of democracy globally. The diametrically opposed opinion says all the talk about non-Western models of democracy or regionally specific models of democracy are largely disingenuous, and they're largely a cloak for authoritarian politics. That when leaders around the world say they want a different model of democracy from Western democracy, often what they mean in reality is that they want less democracy. They want a kind of soft form of authoritarianism. My book comes down in the middle of those two positions. It walks a fairly thin line, I'm aware of that. It walks a fairly thin line in saying this is an important issue. We should be taking calls for different varieties of democracy, greater variation in political forms, much more seriously, not just theoretically or academically, but in practical political terms, in terms of Western international foreign policies than we're doing at the moment. So this is a legitimate agenda. It's not simply a cloak for authoritarians around the world. But there are very serious problems with the concept of non-Western democracy, and we do need to be alert to those problems and dangers when we're debating what kinds of variations and varieties to political reforms are legitimate and are really demanded around the world. For me, the answer to the riddle then is that the most promising way forward is to break democracy down into its very specific component parts and to explore what potential for variation between different regions and different countries exist, rather than debating about some kind of illusory wholesale non-Western model of democracy that is kind of fundamentally different from debates that take place over democracy within the West itself. So that's my basic argument. To take a step back, why is this an important issue at the moment? I believe it's an important issue because we've got several factors that have coincided to push this issue to the top of the international agenda. So widespread feeling around the world and within the West itself that Western democracies are not really delivering to their citizens. They're not really proving themselves to be very accountable or highly responsive to the way in which citizen demands are evolving. There's a feeling that as non-Western rising powers have become more successful economically, they also want their political ideas and not merely their economic ideas to be taken more seriously on the international stage. All the protests, the civic protests we have witnessed around the world in the last 5 years, as you all know, have taken place in an unprecedentedly large number of countries in all regions of the world. These have generated debates about new forms of accountability, new forms of democratic representation, new forms of democratic activism. So these kinds of protests have fed into these calls for different varieties in democratic systems. It's also a reaction, I think, to globalism, people feeling that they need greater ownership over their own political systems as a kind of counterpoint to globalization. Then there is also the debate, I'm sure you're all aware of, over hybrid democratic transitions. I'm sure you all know this, but a very common phenomenon today is that countries that seem to be transitioning out of authoritarianism don't make a smooth unilinear transition to full-scale consolidated liberal democracy. They get stuck and they exhibit elements of authoritarianism and elements of genuine democracy. And people have always defined these kind of hybrid political systems as a kind of temporary staging post on the way to something that looks more or less like Western liberal democracy. It's become clearer that these types of political systems are not temporary staging posts on the way, necessarily on the way to something else, but they're almost political regime types in and of their own right. And finally, an issue which has generated much interest is that the clear failure of a lot of conflict interventions around the world over the last decade, in particular Iraq and Afghanistan. You all know about the liberal peace-building agenda, the feeling that on the back of conflict interventions, the international community would try to support institution building largely along a kind of liberal democratic model. That the failure, the seeming failure of that in key states around the world is something else which has driven greater interest around the world in different types of democracy. So they're the basic reasons why I think this issue is an important issue and why it merits being taken more seriously. Other side of the coin, what are some of the problems with the calls one hears for non-Western democracy? I think there are a number of key problems. One problem is in the social sphere. Often people around the world will say, we don't want Western or liberal democracy because it seems to come with a set of very liberal social norms which we don't want for our own societies. I think this correlation, this linkage between certain set of social norms, whether one agrees with them or not, and a particular type of political system is actually quite problematic. It's a very, very complicated debate. And I'm not saying there's not a link there at all, but at least we ought to be alert to the fact this is a very complicated agenda. And when leaders around the world say our society adheres to very conservative values, religious values, moral values, therefore we want a political system that is fundamentally different from liberal democracy, this correlation is not necessarily convincing. Second sphere where there's problems is the economic sphere. Another very powerful argument one hears from people around the world is, again, we are sceptical about Western-style liberal democracy because it seems to come inextricably entwined with neoliberal economics. Again, the relationship, and Mary's written on this, and people have been debating this for many years, the relationship between certain types of economic reform and certain and types of political reform, again, is very, very complicated. And often one feels that when people say they want a different type of democracy, actually what they're after is a different type of economic outcomes, a different type of economic policy making. So I think at least we need to debate this very complex relationship between political reform and economics. I think there are also problems about certain fairly kind of essentialist argument, cultural arguments. Again, many regimes around the world use this cultural argument that societies have certain types of cultural norms that simply don't lend themselves to the kind of adversarial liberal democratic system. It seems to me one thing that's interesting over the last decade is that as more and more governments and more leaders make this argument, in turn there is more and more opposition from many civil society organisations who have a more kind of modernist agenda, one might say, rejecting this argument and saying, look, over the long term, cultural identities evolve. They are not static. They are not forever. They are not eternal. And that as political reform unfolds, so a society's cultural identity also changes in parallel with it. So I could go on. The book explains in greater detail some of the further problems I think exist with this argument over non-Western democracy. But that gives you a flavour of some of the reasons why I think we do need to take care. I personally think the sentiment behind this call for greater variety in different models of democracy around the world is a powerful one, it's a legitimate one, but we do need to be aware with very real, I would argue, very palpable problems that exist with this argument in favour of non-Western democracy. If I just have 30 seconds to finish, what's the solution then? What's the solution? The book advocates a concept of what I call liberalism plus. Liberalism plus. It argues that in supporting democracy, here I come more to the kind of practical international policy implications. When international organizations try their best to support democratic reform around the world, they should adhere more to the kind of spirit of tolerance and mutual learning that I think was at the heart of the original liberal project. This means taking other societies' ideas and debates on board without sliding into these overly essentialist cultural arguments. It's a very difficult balance to strike for policymakers, but I think that's the kind of terrain on which we need to debate the kinds of policies that international organisations follow. And again, just to give you a couple of examples where I think there is potential that can be explored. One area I think is with the idea of individual democratic rights and the relationship between individual rights and community values. One thing you often hear, one message you hear from non-Western societies is that liberal democracy is all about protecting the individual from the state. It's not about empowering the community for certain types of religious or communal moral identities. And I think anything that international organisations can do to demonstrate that individual democratic rights, the whole narrative of democratic rights, are not simply about protecting the individual, but they're also about creating the conditions for a community to pursue its own set of moral values. And in particular, I think to overcome this perception that has grown that somehow liberal democracy, protecting liberal rights, is antithetical to religion. I think that's been very damaging to the kind of narrative of liberal democracy over the last decade. And then perhaps I've got three or four, but if I can perhaps just mention one more, that's, I think, the issue of economic justice. Yeah. That, again, I think is a very legitimate claim that's being made around the world. And I feel that international organisations are not doing enough to support organisations that espouse different kinds of economic models, or doing more to support more participative processes of economic decision-making. Many people would go to the kind of opposite extreme of saying that any kind of market reform around the world is bad for democracy. I think that's taking the argument too far, but I think being more exploratory in the relationship between economic reform and political reform is urgently needed, much more than we've done to date. I think I probably used up my time. I had a couple of further examples, particularly on the relationship between non-Western models of conflict that we can perhaps explain. But I think my basically concluding headline would be the following, that is a very kind of fine balance to strike between supporting legitimate aspirations for varieties of democratic model without giving voice to the more problematic elements of the calls behind non-Western democracy. I feel that international organisations for a long time were too dismissive of the need to support variations in democratic models, ideas for political reform from around the world that may not fit the Western model. That needs to change, but I think also international organisations need to avoid going to the other extreme of thinking that simply supporting a non-Western model somehow provides a kind of magical solution to all the difficulties that we're experiencing at present with democratic reform and democracy support around the world.
Okay, thank you very much. That's great.
So let's go next.
We're changing the order.
Sorry.
So we're going to Senna.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Richard, for the excellent book, actually. I've read the book earlier on, and I liked it very much. And I do also agree that the book is very timely, given, you know, that indeed, you know, generally we're debating Western representative democracy a lot these days, and also witnessing a reshaping of global power dynamics as well. Also, you know, we're also seeing the rise of civil protest movements across the globe. So this is a time when this issue is in fact is being discussed a lot. Now, as Richard himself argues, I mean, this is what I actually like to start the discussion with, that we need to be very careful with the Western, non-Western divide. I mean, it's already been mentioned earlier, but you know, we also need to keep in mind that there are successful cases in the West, and also those in the so-called non-West that indeed still look to the Western model for inspiration, and sometimes also for legitimacy and support against domestic non-reformers or reform-resistant forces in those societies. So perhaps it might be better to interpret this as the wider spread of the democracy debate, or perhaps the widening of geographic contributions to this, you know, just so that we prevent essentialisms or essentializing of any kind. Now, of course, when we talk about non-Western democracy, I mean, I'm using the term since this is the name of the book, but I mean, yes, of course, there are claims to democracy in various different parts of the world. We've been witnessing it in the last decade or in the last recent years. And there are certain regions as well where we see, you know, certain developments that make this debate very central. I mean, for instance, when we look at the Middle East, we've recently seen two developments which, again, you know, gave a lot of popularity to this debate. One, of course, was the Arab uprisings in 2011. Another one was in Turkey, with the rise of this neo-Islamist Justice and Development Party to power in 2002. where, you know, there was a lot of debate about the, you know, combination or sort of the harmony between Islam and democracy, a successful Islamist party coming to power, etc. I'm not going to say that these were right or wrong, but basically, you know, this, in fact, very much took place within this larger paradigm of this non-Western democracy taking hold. But when we look at these cases, and many others in the world, and also in the Middle East in particular, we don't see any of these cases reaching the liberal model, let alone the liberal plus model, which Richard was talking about. Of course, there are ongoing local debates, as you've been saying, on individual rights, economic justice, communitarian values, alternative forms of representation, legal pluralism, and all these issues that the book also raises. We see that, in fact, progress on these have been very limited. Now, I particularly focus on the Turkish case, not just because I come from Turkey and I work a lot on the country, but also because of the claims of the governing political elite in the country that their understanding of democracy is better than the West. And it's a new version of Western representative democracy. And I think this is a very good example, as Richard was also saying in his speech and also in the book, of, you know, authoritarian practices being cloaked under the banner of a non-Western democracy. So when you actually look at the case closely, you see that the Turkish case, just as similar to us, other so-called rising democracy cases like Brazil, has been suffering for a long time from what I call in some of my own work, from middle democracy trap. I call it the middle-income, middle democracy trap, because it sort of goes hand in hand with the so-called middle income trap, you know, which we're familiar from the literature. So, and this, you know, brings me to the point that Richard was making earlier, is that the economic issue is a very important variable here. And in fact, there's often a dilemma in these cases between economic delivery and consolidation of democracy. So often when they fail to deliver, when they fail to go beyond the middle-income trap, they go for more centralization, they go for erosion of checks and balances. So they often face a difficulty of balancing between economic delivery and democracy here. And again, this is not just about Turkey, it's about Brazil, you see that in other so-called rising powers. Now, and also, again, when we look at the Turkish case, but something that we can generalize to other places in the Middle East as well, I mean, despite all its flaws, especially the Turkish case has demonstrated another aspect, a crucial, perhaps, component that should be present, I think, in Richard's liberal plus model, which is the importance of the secular rule of law. And this, I think, is especially important for strengthening women's rights in a Muslim state, and for the issue of gender equality, which we haven't mentioned so far. So, because often, especially in Muslim settings, when you call for legal pluralism or the incorporation of Sharia law in the within the context of legal pluralism, I think you should sort of approach these calls with a lot of caution, especially for their implications for gender equality. So, in my opinion, we should perhaps be discussing whether or not that legal pluralism in Richard's liberal plus model should be restricted at least by a minimal understanding of secularism. Other cases in the Middle East that we can talk about, the Tunisian case, for instance, shows the importance of power sharing, of consensual model. You know, albeit, you know, despite the fact that it has its problems, still, it also shows perhaps the importance of a learning process. You know, not necessarily that you're learning from good examples, but sometimes perhaps you're learning from bad examples, such as what's been happening in Egypt. The issue of institutionalization, I think, is very important in these cases, like Turkey, Brazil, or Indonesia, for instance. We were in the same group with Richard and like Carnegie, a Rising Democracies Network, and we've been to Indonesia, and I was perplexed to see there how this institutionalization issue matters. You know, the less institutionalized you are, the less of a balance you have between individual rights and communal rights. And in fact, when you look at these different cases, you see that the key elements of the so-called Western model, like secularism, power sharing, institutionalization, are of enduring importance and are of substantial significance still in these claims to democracy in these different parts of the globe. In fact, one can argue that, you know, in certain respects, we're not that far from the so-called Western model. However, when you look at the other side of the coin, that is, when you look at the types or the expressions of claim to democracy by the publics, there perhaps also you might see more variation in the way in which how you see civil society directly intervening or increasing its engagement in trying to foster democratic equality in some of these countries. You see that, for instance, in Brazil, in initiatives by certain civil society organizations in dealing directly with poverty alleviation, where you don't see the extent of that much work being done by civil society organizations elsewhere, for instance, in the West. Or in Turkey, for instance, again, you have certain initiatives. Recently, it's become very popular, the so-called Vote and Beyond initiative, which is a complete volunteer initiative, no money, no financial support, nothing involved, where people go out there, they organize in a tremendous fashion to make sure that free and fair elections are held. Again, I haven't heard of such a case elsewhere, but you see, these are emerging precisely because the trust in governing classes and the governing political elite in these countries are so low, and they cannot deliver on these citizens' claim to democracy. So that there's a big divergence still. Okay, I think.
Thank you. Great. Let's go on to Muklika.
Okay, I'm a social anthropologist amongst political scientists at this table, so I'm going to make that an advantage rather than a disadvantage. But this is a situation I find myself frequently in, so I'm going to voluntarily, I dare say. There are many reasons to like Richard's book, especially because I'm reading it through a very different lens as an anthropologist who thinks about human societies, and I don't just talk about a village or people living in grass, wearing grass skirts, living in mud huts, whatever your image of anthropologists is. Anthropologists also write about democracy. My recent book is called Why India Votes. And it's a particularly opportune time to be talking about these things. We've just had the momentous Turkish elections, which has left my students in despair and colleagues at the table, but also we have the visit by the Prime Minister of India in the UK tomorrow, and a lot of these questions are being thrown up. What do non-Western models of democracy look like? What I particularly like is that there has been a frustration for people who write about non-Western contexts, that if you write about democracy in those non-Western contexts, it's very difficult to bring it in dialogue with political science. And that's been, I think, one of the strongest strengths of your book, that it is acknowledging that there are democratic experiments going on elsewhere which we need to engage with intellectually before we think about policy. And I think that to recognize that there are different models of democracy. And the small caveat to that, which you kind of address, Richard, but I would push you more to talk about here, is how problematized can the category of Western democracy be? What are we referring to? Because the career of democracy in Western settings is very checkered. If you think about Europe through the 20th century, there have been long lapses of democratic practice. So that's one. The second thing is, because I completely take your point that this is generated for policy, but I think it's very difficult to set up a dialogue or there are limits to a dialogue if the intention of the dialogue is to correct the other side. And there is an implicit assumption that there is a flaw which we need to correct, and so therefore can we modify our model to be more nuanced, to take into account variations and flaws. And that might be a little bit unfair to what you're doing, but that's certainly where the non-Western world looks at the Western world from. And I think that perspective is very, very important to take into account, and certainly that's something that my discipline takes very seriously. Now, just briefly, I thought it might be helpful in this audience to talk about some of the key features of Indian democracy, which comes out as a flawed democracy in Richard's tables, and I can see why he puts it there. So I think Japan and Korea come out on top, and then there is a category of flawed democracies, and then hybrid ones and failed ones. The story of India, very briefly, Let me start, if I may, with an ethnographic example about real people, not models. So just on the day of elections in 2009, there was a woman who, we had this long, sort of big comparative ethnographic research across India, and our researcher in the state of Madhya Pradesh found this woman in tears on the day of election. Election day is a holiday in India. And when she asked her, why are you crying, she said, I couldn't vote. She said, well, that's too bad, but you'll get over it. It's not such a big deal, is it? She said, of course it's a big deal. And she said, you know, it's my vote. I wanted to make it count. And she said, you know, but our constituencies are so big. There are millions of voters. You know, every parliamentary constituency in India is 20 times the size of a UK parliamentary constituency, just to give you a perspective. And she said, why does it matter? You know, it's just one vote. Next time you vote. And she said, you see what I do? You know what my job is? In this agricultural market where the farmers bring the grain and they weigh the grain and they sell it and traders buy it and so on, my job at the end of the day is to sweep up all the grain that's fallen to the floor, and then we measure that, and whatever the price of that grain is, I get half of that as payment. So I know I spend my entire working life chasing every grain that makes the heap. So I know that it's my vote that contributes to the heap. I know the value of every grain. Now, this woman earns less than $1 a day, certainly. She's illiterate. She's middle-aged. She is as bottom of the pyramid as you can get. Now, where do we locate such a story in our story of democracy? That's the question I'm posing. Now, if you look at India's case, the transition issue of, you know, it's a clear and sharp transition. There's independence. There is a serious exercise of writing the Indian Constitution. It is produced in less than 3 years. It is brought into, it's put into practice. And it puts into practice some key ideas, which are certainly taken. It's a Westminster style that is brought in. But there are also interesting innovations, like the Uniform Civil Code, which you need to have in such a diverse country. So there is a model of secularism, but it's a very peculiar hybrid model of secularism. It is not the secularism that is borrowed from fairly uniform nation states that where democracy is practiced, but it is one that is created for the Indian context. There is universal suffrage right from the start, regardless of any characteristics, and there is a constitutional provision for holding elections. So the election commission that is put in place has constitutional authority, which means it's above political interfering. And I think, you know, for students, I think it's always very interesting to understand the politics of any country is to ask who runs the election commission in that country. That is always a very revealing bit of information. It also puts into place another innovation of the mixed economy, which, you know, and India has lost its way on that badly. But there is the notion of welfare that is taken and put into practice in this sort of mixed economy model, such that the economy also has a moral responsibility, a political responsibility, and it is brought into play with the state and planning. So it is a hybrid of what, you know, the Soviet Union is a close ally, but then so is America would, and there is a very conscious decision that whatever is put in place as a democratic institution for contemporary India has to be one that is a designer democracy. It has to be designed for specifically for the needs of this society. And as a result, there obviously are other characteristics. But 60 years down the road, since 1947, nearly 70 years down the road, what you get is our stories, like Rukmini Bai, who I mentioned at the beginning of, about this woman and the grain heap, who very much sees herself when elections come round as a citizen. Now, yes, I completely take the point that holding free and fair elections is not a sufficient, but certainly a necessary condition for marking off any society as democracy. We are all fairly agreed on that. But it's not just about elections. I think what is interesting is engaging with real people, engaging with democratic institutions, is when you probe that, as we try to do, you really see that this is about political participation. So it raises all the issues that, you know, of your 5 points at the end of the book of what is the minimal but working and sufficient conditions of this liberalism plus model. And Richard very helpfully has five aspects to it that he lists. It creates a lot of what people reveal in that moment of political participation is really ideas about how they think of themselves in non-electoral times. And one of the triumphs of that democratic vision, therefore, is somehow that, you know, is democracy the best way to eradicate poverty? Well, democracy's responsibility is not, you know, that relationship of democracy and poverty is a very complicated one. But democracy, or the democratic vision, has something quite fundamental to do with the idea of equality and equivalence, if you want to say, call it that. And what that vision of participation and the tiers is really about, this is the only moment in social life where I, as a absolutely impoverished woman, is counted exactly equally to everybody else. It doesn't matter who I am, where I come from, what my thoughts are, whether I have dirt under my fingernails, whether my sari is torn, I will be treated with respect when I face, when I enter the polling booth. And given so many of these contexts us, that Richard describes are such deeply unequal ones, what democracy does in these contexts is to provide a political vision that allows for a certain hope. I mean, it's really, you know, when you say a politician is a dealer in hope, that's really what they're doing, is to be able to imagine a polity that is about equality, which comes with a certain set of rights. And another woman said to us, well, of course I will vote because, you know, it's free and it's foundational. Of course I want education for my children and I want health care for the family, but if I don't exercise the one right that is given to me freely, how can I dare to ask for other things or petition? You know, so how can I be an activist if I can't do what I can do so easily and freely? So the point being that participation in elections is really symptomatic of a whole other set of ideas of citizenship and duty and rights. And finally, just the final point I want to make is that, you know, I puzzle over this issue of why it works and why people in such a divided and hierarchical and violent society like India, where large parts of the population are not only impoverished but vulnerable to violence on the basis of caste, on the basis of gender, on the basis of age, and so on. Why is it that this commitment to participation continues to remain? And by the way, participation rates in Indian elections goes up every single election. Every single election that participation is going up. So clearly there is some commitment to it. And of course there's the instrumentality of do they get money and do they get so on. You know, we can talk about that if you're interested, but that's not what Richard's book is about. But I think there is another fundamental point which relates directly to Richard's argument is, you can only, you know, yes, put aside these issues, as you said, of social norms, of cultural norms, of essentialism, absolutely. But if the vision, and I don't say model, but the vision, the democratic vision, is one that has resonance with models of cooperation, of identity, of participation that already exist in that society, such that people don't feel it's a completely alien set of norms that's being imposed on you, but rather one that is created from the bottom up or is likely to resonate with non-political forms of participation, there is likely to be much greater engagement with the democratic vision than we see in some places. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And what you've done is really to draw attention to, in a sense, two very different ways of thinking about democracy, as sort of what it means for the individual, if you like, a subjective view, and a sort of more procedural view, which I think is that there's always that tension. I mean, I often tell the story that when I was doing an evaluation of EU democracy programs, we started off by asking people what they thought democracy meant. And when we asked people in Brussels, they said elections, freedom of associations, rule of law. When we asked people in Eastern Europe who were newly democratic, they said things like, it means that the bureaucrats are now my servants. It means that I have to take responsibility for my own life. So it was really fascinating, and I think that's a tension. And I think what's really interesting now, which we might, is that that subjective sense of democracy is what we're really lacking in the West. That people feel, you know, the slogan of the Spanish indignados, they call it democracy, but it isn't, is a sense that representative democracy is not delivering in that deep subjective sense. I won't ask you to comment now, but I'll take some questions because I hope it'll be rather a round of discussion as much. So we have Heber here, so Heber may want to add a few words to all of this. Heber, could you bear to stand up so everyone can see you? Heber is from Egypt.
I was thinking about the cases that we are witnessing in the Middle East, that is why the Middle East. And I think that we have two problems, that in many cases democracy is used as a facade for fascism. And the return of the different social and political powers, be it the military or businessmen who come from the military background, etc. And democracy suits them very well. The vision is that you can use the facade, you can avoid criticism internationally, but at the same time there is nothing there. The second thing is that democracy is also suitable for those who do not want to confront the West from the Islamic groups. So we have the example of the Islamo-neoliberal sort of groups, and the very clear model for that is the case of Turkey, but actually in a subtle way, the case of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Actually, they were very happy to assume that they can be in cooperation with the European Union, they had different visits to the states, they assumed that they can manage along the way, and they used actually democracy in a way that was based on mobilization, addressing the religious sentiments of people, and eventually the whole thing collapsed. And when it collapsed, they were putting a lot of hope on Western support and human rights global movements, etc. So again, there is that fascination with the liberal model. And I think that some of the things that have been mentioned under the title of sort of local democracy or vernacular dimensions of participation, etc., can, as much as they can be put under the title of democracy, they can be put under the title of informality and actually anarchism as well, in a positive way, not anarchism, but the way of how people actually use their own authority to organize their own spaces and manage and survive with the collapse of the services that the state is actually providing. So the map of ideas and labeling, you know, it's too much complicated, but I think that democracy is usually used as a wider blanket, you know. This is democratic, this is Islamic democratic, this is social democratic, this is... Why are we stuck with the notion? If the notion is a value in itself as an idea, then be it. But if the notion is sort of the vehicle for liberalism or global neoliberalism, then I have an issue with that. There's also the dimension of democracy and war. In many cases, if you just go through the last 20 years, either democracy led to wars, so when people came out to manifest their different identities, we witnessed clashes, so we had this wave of democratic transition and then it collapsed in different third world countries, or after an experience of democracy, people went into... after an experience of military rule, people went into the cycle of democracy and then military rule again. You can mention different examples in Eastern Europe, to some extent in the Middle East as well. So I think that there is an issue that needs to be addressed. I've been working on the project of building global democracy. It was a 5 years project funded by Ford Foundation. We were 10 conveners from 10 different areas, from 10 different regions of the group, from the Pacific to Canada, to Africa, to Latin America, to India, to Russia. And we wanted to introduce new notions and see these dimensions of global democracy, but I can't actually understand them except under the notion, by the notion of multiple modalities. Because if we say different types of democracy, then you're just trying to be under this ceiling of neoliberalism and liberalism and global capitalism. But if you say multiple modalities, then you go a bit back and then you see that maybe you have different perspectives on how society should be built. And hybridity has been criticized as well, because it's like this melting pot and we are all the same, but what things that are hybrid, the components of the melting pot themselves melt. So it does not necessarily guarantee. All it becomes, the festivities multiculturalism. So actually, your book is very important. I have not had the opportunity to have the book and read it, but I think it's important because it's raising the whole these questions about democracy and globality, something that actually LSE and Mary Camus have been working on for about almost 15 years now in global civil society research that you can read.
Hakan, I'll take.
Thanks for the panel, which was very interesting, very brief but very rich. I haven't read the book, so I'm just commenting on what I heard, so apologies for that. One thing, well, two things actually. One, which I'm not quite clear about, is we talk about global democracy beyond the Western model, etc., but we end up actually talking about liberal democracy. So are these things are synonym to democracy and liberal democracy, why liberal democracy? And when people are reacting from what we consider to be the Western models or against them, which bit of the formulation they are reacting to? Is it the liberal bit or the democratic? What does democracy, in a way, politically do for people, what they achieve through democratic process? Does it have to be liberal? And the other point is, I'm not also very clear, it seems, whether this is the presentation or in the way generally the book is framed, you seem to be addressing the international organizations and their work supporting. I'm slightly puzzled with that, because I'm sort of thinking, well, if there's an external definition of what they're supposed to be supporting, can it ever be local democracy? And can it ever engage with local processes in the way local processes are shaping political process in some kind of participatory manner without being defined by this way or that?
I'm going to add to that question, and then we'll have a first round of answers, and then we'll go back to the audience. But I suppose the one thing that always strikes me when I read books about democracy is that democracy is always discussed in national contexts. More than any other subject, actually, it suffers from what Ulrich Beckel and Janot Schulte call methodological nationalism. And yet, you know, so much of what's going wrong today really has to do with growing interconnectedness, the fact that communities cross borders and they don't fit neatly into states, the fact that however perfect your democracy, if decisions are being taken in Brussels or in the headquarters of multinationals, you can't respond to the demands of your citizens. Maybe a bit different in India, because India is sufficiently big. But I just feel, you know, what to me was so worrying in a way about the Arab Spring was that the things that they asked for, I couldn't see how they could be achieved in a national context. I have the same worry about Syriza and Podemos. They can't get their anti-austerity policies unless we get it on a European and perhaps even a global scale. So I throw that into the pot. And maybe we should go in the opposite order, or whoever wants to start.
Well,
Richard. 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 Yeah, he should be able to reply to
everything. You're going to solve the world.
I think probably the natural starting point for the discussion is Hakim's very good kind of definitional question. So I have a section in the book which basically says, when people talk about non-Western democracy, is that synonymous with non-liberal democracy? Because those two terms tend to get thrown around, at least in the kind of more policy-oriented circles, that because I work in a think tank, I mean, I happen to kind of circulate in those. These two terms get thrown around as if they were the same thing. And my line is, I mean, this is a horrendously complicated debate. My line is that they are not the same thing. There is a significant overlap, but they are they're distinct analytical categories. The skeptical voices would say, look, when people around the world are pushing for non-Western democracy, when they're talking about Latin American democracy or African democracy or Arab democracy or Asian democracy, what actually they're talking about is illiberal democracy. It's a less liberal form of democracy, and we should not entertain that, yeah, as the international community. I disagree with that in the book. I think there are interesting innovations and experiments coming out of non-Western countries that are about improving democratic quality in a way that is not illiberal. So non-Western ideas and experimentation, for me, doesn't have to sit at odds with basic liberal concepts. That's basically how I define it. But it's very, very tricky because these terms are contested within societies. Heber referred to some of the debates. When people are pushing back, my experience is that today they're actually pushing back much more against liberalism as a concept rather than democracy. And often I sometimes feel we in the West simplify debates in other countries. Often sometimes people in other countries can perhaps simplify some of the debates that are taking place in the West. I mean, in Podemos and other, that are about some of these same issues, as Mary says. So I think that's, you know, liberalism kind of, in a way, has given democracy a bad name. And it doesn't need to. It doesn't need to, because you can separate out the two concepts. And that's what I try to do in the book, saying, you know, in the social sphere and the economic sphere. I personally, Heber, wouldn't go quite as far as you in saying that different models of democracy are meaningless unless they tackle capitalism. I wouldn't go as far as that. But I would say that There ought to be more experimentation in saying, look, different kinds of economic decision making, more participative economic decision making, can help revitalize democracy, even if they're not the same kind of civil society organizations that may fit the mold of what exists in the West. And that there I would make the bridge to Mukulika's lovely metaphor of the grain collector, that I basically think more or less summarizes the gist of what I'm trying to argue in the book. And your notion of the kind of designer democracy, I think is a lovely way of basically making the point very succinctly. Instead of arguing whose model is best, what kind of model is somehow kind of eternally suited to a particular society, there should be two-way learning today. The conditions through interdependence are much more in place for this two-way learning, and this is more or less what Yannatos was writing about in his article. I think he goes a bit too, personally, I think he goes a bit too far in saying there are no red lines. You know, more or less, whatever comes out of other societies should be taken as authentic and legit. I think there are red lines. I know some people won't agree with that, but I think there are certain rights. Gender rights, I think, is one where the kind of liberal core is legitimate, and as I think this is Sanem's very important point, talk of authenticity shouldn't be indulged because where it's infringing upon those kind of core rights, and we shouldn't be too defensive about saying that. I think the aim of the debate is actually not, and it's worrying to me that you perhaps picked this up from the book, it's not about actually debating liberal democracy or Western democracy and correcting others that think differently. That I think that's been the problem within the policy community. And we should be getting around. And there is a big section in the book about how countries like Brazil, South Africa, India, Korea, until recently Turkey, and Salim has written lots on this within the context of our project, themselves are seeking to support interesting experiments in different types of politics in other countries, I mean, beyond their own borders. I think it's important that we don't over-idealise what's going on in other parts of the world, but that we just open ourselves to this kind of two-way experimentation and learning. And I think a lot of that has to do with things that you've been writing on in the past, and others here as well, getting beyond this notion that democratic activism or democratic citizenship is that which is arranged around kind of professionalized political activity. Often it's not, it's informal, it's the most interesting stuff is often non-political. And that's where I would slightly take issue with Hakim on the potential that is there for the international community to do more good than it has done so far. Because in a way, you're basically questioning the whole essence of trying to support good quality democracy in other countries. You're saying basically just conceptually it doesn't make sense because good quality democracy has to come from below within societies, and that simply cannot be supported from outside. First of all, I think the international community can do a lot more to make sure it doesn't harm those local processes. And I think that is an essential part of democracy promotion that is meaningful. And secondly, it can do more to partner and to facilitate, not to directly determine these kind of local processes, but at least to facilitate and give them more room than it has done in the past. I think it's important not to over-instrumentalise that. I think the worst thing the EU or the US can do is to go to the likes of India or Turkey and say, look, help us support Islamic democracy because we haven't got a clue how to do it. Here, take 100 million, do it for us. And often you do hear, I mean, that sounds a caricature of the debate, but you do hear people talking, particularly in US democracy support organisations, who say, you know, when I was kind of talking to them about the book, and said, well, of course we support different models of democracy. It's about getting India signed up to, you know, our understanding of different models of democracy and doing this. Why aren't they with us? Why aren't they with us on this? And I think that there needs to be a bit more nuance and subtlety.
Okay. Should I go next? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Just because I'm itching to say in response to some things that Richard. I'm sorry. Would you like to go?
No.
Okay. Okay. 3 points in response to the questions and what Richard's just said. I just made up the term designer democracy, but I agree with you, it's quite nice, isn't it? It does.
Copyrighted quick,
right. Yeah, but, you know, the first point, which you've been talking about and Hakim mentioned, is it's the politics of policy making. Right? And there is, like you were saying, caricature or not, that's exactly the climate in which these conversations happen. And you say the US and Europe. You know, the non-Western world looks at the Western world and says, well, lip service to democracy is not living democracy. Look at what you do with democratic regimes around the world. It has to be your kind of dictator or that is allowed. It could be a democracy that you may or may not like, and it is entirely at your convenience. So even this engagement is so political and so backed by geostrategic interest that this, you know, I absolutely support your intellectual labor in making this conversation happen, but what makes it so difficult is that anyone listening is so aware of that politics, and people in the non-Western world are a heck of a lot more political than they are in the Western world, in the US and Europe, and they're aware of these. So it's to create the space for a genuine conversation is difficult, and, you know, all grease to your elbow and we'll join the fight. The second point is about the liberal core and concepts of democracy. Now, the liberal core, you know, just to be able to link, de-link the residents of the liberal core somewhere in the mid-Atlantic would be helpful. Somehow the liberal core of ideas exists in US North America, and everywhere else are sort of variations of it, or sometimes we get a flowering of it. You know, that there is a spatiality to these imaginations. And if we can provincialize each version of liberalism, we might be getting somewhere. Let's provincialize Europe and North America too. They are also a variation. A congressman and how he behaves politically is very different to a Westminster MP. And they are variations of a sort of, you know, shared vision of the democratic vision. But they're not alike in any fundamental way. And if we can create, so the multiple modernities idea, you know, this is what I think that multiple modernities is about, that idea, that modernity is not one thing, and people imagine, you know, the teleology in it can be widely varying, and therefore people's ontology of modernity is so important to understand it. Which takes me to the final point, which is the third point, which is how important it is for policy and anyone thinking about these issues to think about the non-political areas of life, because nobody is a political actor, and that a political actor doesn't stop being a mother or a farmer or a school teacher and all the other roles that they fulfill. And part of the, you know, the cultural sensitization, I agree with you completely that too much cultural relativism is a bad thing, absolutely. But when we talk about the importance of the cultural, it is not so much about essentialism, that certain cultures are X or Y, but it is recognizing that non-political areas of life affect the political. So unless you look for liberal forms of participation, or unless you look at indigenous models of cooperation, without which you have no notion of citizenship, or if you don't have ideas of autonomy that come out of kinship, say, or out of agriculture, how do people have work parties and share labor, you're not going to have any understanding of how those people are going to behave politically. And again, what I find difficult, you know, and because I talk to more political scientists than I talk to anthropologists, and it is just, I don't, it's the hegemony, it's the politics of knowledge as well as much as the politics of policy, but it is almost impossible to foreground the non-political in discussions of the political, which I think is what we should be doing. Thank you.
Okay, just two brief points. On Heather's comment about the West, now often I think, you know, these movements like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Turkish AKP and others, you know, often it is the case that they see the West as a source of legitimacy, as you say, sort of to strengthen themselves against the other sort of domestic forces or authoritarian forces like the military, judiciary, whatever, until, at least in the Turkish case, we managed to see that, but of course in the Egyptian case, we couldn't get to that stage, until that stage when they have unchallenged power. And when they do have unchallenged power, you know, they don't need the West anymore. And then you're talking about a completely different set of relationships. However, the bad news is that often the West is okay with that.
Exactly.
Given its strategic interests. I mean, right now we're facing a situation that the West have chosen to deal with Erdogan as long as he, quote-unquote, contains, this is the language that they're using, unfortunately, the Syrian refugees.
Right.
And he's fine. You know, what, he can get away with, you know, authoritarianism at home, as long as he cooperates with Europe on certain issues. They even deferred, they delayed the publication of Turkey's progress report up until after the elections, so that it wouldn't hurt Erdogan in the pre-election phase. Now, what kind of democratic credibility would Europe have? And this is really, I mean, in the eyes of the Turkish sort of reformers, but, you know, like serious reformers, not the AKP and its supporters, you know, they feel like, you know, they've lost a main partner in advancing democracy. Not that, you know, nobody was expecting the EU to come with a recipe of democracy promotion and sort of to deal with this issue in Turkey, which hadn't been dealt with for decades, but at least, you know, they wouldn't expect this kind of behavior. So I think this is something that we need to be very careful about, you know, the notion. And in Turkey is an enlargement country. You know, this is where you would expect the most of democratic conditionality. So I think it's sad also to a certain extent. And also, the authoritarian leaders are not stupid. They know exactly how to deal with the West. Erdogan had been very careful. He knew exactly, you know, what he could put on the table. It was no coincidence that hundreds and thousands of refugees started to flood into Turkey, especially this summer. Everybody knew where they were going from. Everybody knew the routes. The public knew about it. You know, it was impossible for the state not to know about it. You know, just as Putin, how he uses, you know, the oil and gas as an instrument, Erdogan has now, you know, started to use the refugee numbers as an instrument. It's exactly the same logic, and they know how to deal with the West and how to tone down the criticism of democracy when it comes to it. And finally, on this participation issue, again, I mean, wonderful metaphor, but, you know, sometimes the rate of participation or the feeling behind the need to participate in some of these societies does not just, you know, come perhaps out of the feeling of, you know, the feeling of participating or feeling of self-respect or in this liberal mode, but sometimes it's precisely illiberal tendencies that push people to participate. There's an irony there. I mean, again, I keep on going back to the Turkish context because it's just so relevant also to what we're talking about right now. I mean, for instance, in the Turkish case, 90% was the turnout rate, which is very high. It's even higher in the June elections. And it's not necessarily because people felt like, you know, that they were doing this for democracy or they were feeling that they were included in the system by doing this, but mostly because the government made it sound like this was a matter of survival, that they would come to power again and that they would enhance their security, right? By creating a very strong one-man rule. So often a large chunk of that 50% majority that went to vote for them voted out of this very perhaps illiberal mode of necessity, which, you know, just goes to show, again, of course, which brings us back to the sense that I love that phrase, a subjective sense of democracy, that sometimes exists even in the so-called apolitical sort of individual level, which, you know, however apolitical it is, especially in most of these contexts that we're talking about, as you said, they can be very political, you know, even the taxi driver or whatever, because they're sort of, they live with that current constantly.
I think we're living through a period, whether we like it or not, we're forced to be political. And that has its interesting sides, interesting times. I mean, one doesn't want to say it has its good sides, because we have to be political for very bad reasons. The other thing I was thinking as you spoke, that this interest of donors and the international community in non-Western democracies is a sort of Orientalism. And actually, what people don't realise, and it's something I see in all the conflict zones I study, you know, the Westerners come along, we're going to teach you to have civil society, we're going to solve your conflicts, and all the time they're being completely manipulated by people on the ground who understand the situation much better, and they're being used to legitimise certain positions or not. So I think that's a really important way of thinking about all of this. We've got lots of people who want to speak now. So Armin, and then you come next. So Armin first.
Thank you.
Mary, can we ask somebody to open a window? It's very, very hot. Maybe at one at the back.
To echo some of what has already, you know, I have a high level of skepticism about democracy promotion, having been in the former Soviet countries, where one of the worst consequences was that democracy became completely delegitimized on the ground because it was linked very closely to the other transition agenda of building a free market economy. And when people, you know, link those, I think now there's an attempt to revitalize, redefine not just democracy, but also civil society and all of these concepts. So I think when we focus on the role of international community, you said, you know, for them not to do harm, but I think we have to really, I mean, do you still believe that you can promote democracy from outside? Because I'm very skeptical. I think I agree with Pepe that it has to be a grassroots organic process. In terms of, you know, we are talking about Western democracy as if it's still this, you know, okay, it's got slight problems, but it's still working. But when you look at the protests within Europe, they're very critical of liberal democracy. They're very,
you know, one of the demands is we want real democracy. So how is real democracy linked to this Western model that you're talking about? I think it's very important because they definitely de-link it from the liberal model. And that's why, you know, you can call it liberalism plus. In other contexts, they've called it inclusive liberalism. But I think it's, you know, maybe not going far enough. Maybe we have to really rethink whether liberalism, you know, is truly linked with democracy. Because we're still in this triumphalist discourse, the end of history model. You know, we haven't let go of that. So I just put that out there because I think it's something where we think the problem is over there, but the problem is actually perhaps here. And, you know, now there's more and more books coming out about neoliberalism killing democracy, capitalism killing democracy. And they're not writing about Turkey or Brazil or, you know, India. They're talking about the United States. So
Donald Trump. Yeah.
In fact, my question is like very, very similar to where she ended, in the sense that when we talk about this comparison between Western and non-Western democracy, are we essentially falling down to this whole fact that okay, non-Western democracies lack in terms of material economic outcomes, but then when other aspects on which we criticize or we look down upon non-Western democracies, in some ways those aspects exist even in Western democracies, in the sense that in terms of corruption, you might have a certain type of corrupt leaders ruling in non-Western democracies, but in Western democracies, as she also mentioned, you have this whole idea of corporate interests and lobbyists installing leaders. We've seen the financial crisis, how the financial crisis came about, then the whole role of how in non-Western democracies you have highly emphasized on social cleavages in politics, but that's the same way politics is even in Western democracies. For example, in US, the black divide, the racial divide in politics is extremely sharp. So many things that we see and we criticize non-Western democracies are in the essentially intrinsic part of electoral politics, which gets reflected in both places.
Thank you. And now there was. What, didn't you in the pink shirt have something to say or not?
I come back to me, actually. I was listening.
Okay, so you'd like to say something.
Well, pretty similar to what she's been said. I'm just curious as to what the sort of success conditions are for sort of these non-Western models, because it feels like a lot of what's being said is hinting at it being whether we can successfully define it as democracy. So, liberal democratic principles, liberal freedoms for individuals, as opposed to things sort of like governmental stability, provisional national security, economic reforms, these sorts of things.
Anybody else want to start? Yes, go ahead.
So one of the things that I came tonight for was I was very interested in this idea of variation in democracy. And you guys, the panel, thank you, you presented some ideas of variation. I guess one of the things that surprised me is when we actually talk about variation, I thought we were talking about like genuine variations. And it seemed, when I looked at the variation that it described between congressmen and MPs, yeah, sure, they're different. But it's sort of superficial differences to me. Like, I would imagine that variation in democracy would be much larger. I mean, all the systems we see around the world seem to be every few years, you go down to a post office and you stamp and, the tick box next to a person, and then they rule for 5 or so years or something like that. That seems to be the same, just about everywhere. It doesn't seem like there's much variation at all. Is my confused? Do you see a genuine amount of variation, or maybe you don't have enough imagination?
Okay. I want to make one point, mainly in relation to Hakan and Armin, which is that if we think today's world is deeply interconnected, there's external interference all the time, and there are good forms of external interference and bad forms. It may be the case that democracy promotion, which means giving lots of money to artificially created NGOs, is a bad thing. But on the other hand, you know, when you think about the role that human rights activists played in North America in relation to Latin America, the sort of thing that Sicking and co. describe, the similar things that happened in Eastern Europe. I actually think one of the deep problems at the moment with Syria, Turkey, and Egypt is the lack of international transnational solidarity, actually. and that that's terribly important. And nowadays, precisely because you can't have, I don't think, closed societies, it's a different, odd kind of authoritarianism that's being kind of upheld by its global links. That's what's happening. That's what we've heard described in relation to Sisi and Erdogan. So there needs to be some. That's what's lacking, is this kind of transnational sense of solidarity. So I think it's not either internal or external, but it's kind of what sort of transnational links exist and how do they affect things. I'll go back to...
Yes, the question, can you promote democracy from outside? That, I think that's the essence of the argument I would give as well. Remember, there's, just to give one concrete example of that, when the Arab Spring started in 2011, there were at least half a dozen European governments who basically said, we want nothing to do with this. Just let the Middle East get on with it itself. We have to be completely neutral. But you cannot be neutral. You cannot have European governments cannot have a state of affairs where they have no impact one way or the other on the Middle East. Because when those European governments were saying we should be entirely neutral and this has nothing to do with us, their idea of neutrality is we stand aside, we don't give money to democratic activists, to NGOs. But neutrality means us just being able to sell arms, to sell weapons, to trade, to buy oil. And that's not neutrality.
Yeah.
That loads the dice against a particular political outcome, whether you think that that's good or bad. So if you could have a state of neutrality, fine, we could debate it, but you just cannot do that. You cannot do that. I don't think that democracy promotion, I think we just need to change the narrative of it. Democracy promotion is not about and should not be about particular international actors thinking they can determine that a country makes a choice for democracy rather than a choice against democracy. I think that the more sophisticated people involved in democracy organizations around the world are actually well beyond that point. I think actually the academic community has a bit of catching up to do. I think those debates, if you go and talk to the Swedes or the Danes or the Dutch, they're miles, miles beyond that point. What they're trying to do is to build up local participation. They're trying to support civil society organizations to build roots downwards to local communities and upwards to parties, and because that's what really effective voice for your individual grain collector, to make sure her voice kind of has resonance through the political process. I don't think the international community is ever going to be the major determinant of whether a country democratizes or not, but I don't think you can discount it as a factor. Your second question is about the problem actually being in the West. Yes, I have a whole chapter of that on the book. I didn't mention it. And that's, again, the whole essence of my point, that a lot of the, and I know you've been thinking and writing about this, a lot of the debates you see outside the West today mirror the kind of debates you have in the West. I think they have a lot of the same virtues, but I also think they suffer from a lot of the shortcomings. As someone who's been sitting in Madrid for the last decade, the whole Indignados, the Podemos movement has a lot of potential. It's renovated, you say in English? It's kind of renewed, revitalized democratic life in Spain. But nobody who are out there with the slogan saying we want real democracy has any idea what they mean by that. Yeah. And they've got to a kind of limit now of
They thought it was what they did in the squares.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they said, we will never form a political party. We will never compete for political power. And now they are doing that.
Yeah.
They're doing exactly the same. They're experiencing exactly the same kind of corruption scandals that the old parties have. So I think we need to be careful about one thing. And probably I differ from some of you in the comments you've made, that I think we're getting into a kind of slightly confused situation where a lot of organizations that have appeared inside the West and outside the West in the last decade, basically saying real democracy or local democracy or authentic democracy is that which combats free market capitalism. Now, you may be able to make a strong argument against free market neoliberalism. I would share many of those views, but I think that's not a debate about democracy. And if I make myself clear, it's not, I mean, in the context of the EU crisis, people in southern countries basically saying democratizing the EU is basically pushing against austerity. Now, we may need to push against austerity, but that in itself is not about a different model of democracy. So therefore, I think
would you not agree that neoliberalism is somehow fundamentally contradictory to democracy? I think it's really difficult to imagine.
No, but that's not quite the point I addressed in the book. No. I think that there's a huge contradiction there. My point is a bit more subtle. It's tomorrow we could cancel austerity. We could find an economic system that cured all the ills of capitalism. But to me, that doesn't take away the problematic debates about getting democracy right. That wouldn't in itself solve all.
Well, look at Viktor Orban. He's pursuing an anti-austerity policy and a fascist policy. The fascists were the first to introduce Keynesianism. So I'm not necessarily saying that anti-neoliberalism is democracy. But
or is a kind of panacea, which I think relates to a really excellent question about how do we actually measure success? And I discussed that a bit, but it's... it's that democracy isn't an antidote to instability, security instability necessarily. It isn't a magic solution for the problems of economic development. So democracy has a kind of value in itself. I think that's what Mary's getting at with this idea of needing transnational solidarity more than we have at present. But somehow society's different kind of structural requirements in terms of economic growth and their security interests need to be factored into the kind of democracy they try to develop. I do have a section in the book where I talk about countries like Ukraine. I mean, you've just been there and see all these debates about the debates about inclusive government that is needed for stability. You need to build in certain constituencies, whether in the east of Ukraine or the Sunnis in Iraq or the various communities in Syria, to make people feel they have a stake in the political game. And those types of participation may not quite fit the Western template, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be contemplated and supported as much as we can support them, or at least give them space to develop from outside. And then I think the best question was that all this variation is meaningless anyway, which kind of negates the whole purpose of my book. So thanks for that.
So, Sven Herman, do you want to go first again?
Happy to. Okay, again, thank you. 3 points. There's so much one can say, but one, just to respond to Mary's point about transnational solidarity, I think it is interesting that there is so little of it, and it seems to me the two clear factors. One is Islam, which we haven't talked about at all, as if it doesn't matter where the trouble is happening. And there is, people, I think there was a certain left-wing politics that felt more akin to Che Guevara than they do to anything that happens in a Muslim context, because as if that is a completely different planet as opposed to. So that's clearly one reason. The second is surely the point that you were making about Europe and arms sales, that what you're fighting is such a big economic system which fuels conflict. And to say, I mean, you're quite right to slam it like that. It's neutrality in a world where every conflict in that region has a 100-year-old history in which the US and Europe are absolutely central to the creation of those conflicts. I mean, how can you even begin to talk about neutrality? It's absurd. Mm. Certainly what I find with my students in LSE elsewhere that I've taught in Britain, that because there is zero awareness of how their own governments, societies have actually been part of those histories for at least 100 years, is part of the lack of understanding. Where are you going to get transnational solidarity if you don't understand how the world was created? You know, where the lines were drawn, why Iraq and Iran had a war. I mean, none of these things, there's complete lack of understanding. So how are you going to, and that's why we have universities, we hope. The second point is about...
We did have solidarity with South Africa.
I know, that's true. And it was black and white, wasn't it? More.
I think it's something to do with the times we're living in. That's
Well, we can talk about this. But I had to balance a designer democracy, right? So without that fun. But the second thing about austerity and inclusive growth, I mean, here, again, just to support Richard's point, I mean, look what we've got in Britain. You know, I mean, here we have just voted with a clear majority a government that pursues a policy that everybody thinks is rubbish. But it came out through a very, and this sort of raises the larger question even about the recent Turkish elections. I would be less hesitant to call that illiberal or, you know, I think being fearful of instability is not necessarily an illiberal value. If people have been, you know, the manufacturing of that paranoia is illiberal. But I cannot blame, you know, people. So the problem with democracy is often if people elect governments nobody likes, or a vast majority doesn't like, and the way, especially if you're first past the post system, you get a very small vote share, you get lots of seats, you win an election, and, you know, and you're reeling under the impact of it, and the only thing that keeps people going is that you can throw these rascals out. And it's just, you know, it happened in India in 2014, a large, only 31% of the population voted for the right-wing government, but subsequent elections, including the one that was called on Sunday, in a large, you know, call them states in India, they're larger than most European countries, each of those states, has voted that government, you know, very resoundingly against a certain kind of politics. So that's what keeps a democratic system going, and that is all about politics and values rather than the economy. And the third point about variation, you're quite right. I think, you know, to make a distinction between the congressman and the is it perhaps not the best example. What I was trying to get at is something slightly more abstract, but and possibly more profound, which is that often when we use words like vote and elections and representatives and legislatures, we think we understand what those points mean, what those words mean. But each of these words in different democratic contexts mean very different things. So representation is a very good concept. The variation of popular understandings of what representation is across different democracies is so wide-ranging, you wonder whether we're talking about the same thing, right? But they are talking about the same thing. It is ultimately about who you transfer the right to make decisions on your behalf. And what the relationship of you and your representative is one that, and what you think the representative's role is very, varies very, very widely. So that's the, so every notion of the democratic vision can be, it's not about relativizing it, but it is localizing it to the extent, and provincializing the hegemonic model to the extent that you begin to, you know, you should be able to begin to build a theory of democracy out of India or out of Japan, rather than starting from somewhere in ancient Greece that never existed, you know, which is, so somehow, you know, if you just shift the center of gravity. So why can't you say, well, the Japanese model is the model of democracy you're working with, everything else is a variation. Can you do that? I mean, that's when we can really start talking about variation. That's the point I was making.
Senator.
Yeah, just, well, I don't have any time anyway, so just two very minor points. Just first one is a response to your comment. And in my example, what I really meant to say was that they're very aware of the government's illiberal tendencies, and they're quite happy with it. As long as it suppresses so-called traitors, because they see there's a certain, it's a societal polarization, which was also fueled by the government, and they feel like, you know, other half of society should basically be demolished on the face of the earth. And it's dangerous, but it's a very important voting motivation, part of a certain population. But that's a long story. Other point about the impact of the international and democracy promotion, I do agree with Richard here. I mean, in the sense that you cannot totally dismiss the importance of the international. And when you look at the European Union, although, look, I mean, I've been very critical of the EU and the West in general, but there have been cases where it has been successful. I mean, it has been successful. Of course, there were usually those cases where its interests, of course, were aligned with that success in democracy, like in the case of Central and Eastern Europe, or certain places in Western Balkans, or even in Turkey between 1999 and 2005. And yes, it has been limited, but it hasn't been a complete lack of failure when you look at it like that. So I don't know. I tend to be a little bit hesitant on that point, even though I do criticise it a lot.
Oh gosh, we could go on for hours. And we haven't even started on conflict. So that shows it was a really good discussion. Thank you so much, Richard, for prompting us.